Hey everyone, this is Chris and welcome to another episode of the Bonner Breakdown. We're excited to have Chris Bessler with Keoki with us today. And we're excited for a good conversation, lots of great stories, lots of good information, and we're excited for that. We love interviewing nonprofits, community members, people who've been here a long time. We love getting all the ranges of spectrums as far as opinions and ideas and history. So please, if you know anybody that wants to be on the on a broadcast, on an episode, please get a hold of me. At connect@bonnerbreakdown.com. We're excited. This week's episode is brought to you by Bonner Community Housing Agency. We have a Finally Home class coming up on February 8th. We ask that you go to bonnerhousing.org, register there in order to participate in the class. You get educated in every part of owning a home, from the finances to the mortgage to working with realtors, the whole nine yards. You will come away knowing far more than you thought you knew about buying a home. It's very helpful, especially for anybody who's a first-time home buyer, or if it's been a while, or even if you've owned your home for 20 years and you're about to buy a new house. I've had people take that class and go, I'm so glad I took that. Such a great reminder of some of the details to keep in mind as I'm in my house hunting process. So hopefully you can join us for that on February 8th. Register at bonnerhousing.org. Just click on Finally Home and the links are there to register. I also want to say thank you to our season sponsor, Ting. Ting High Speed Fiber Optic Internet. Crazy fast fiber internet. Ting has done a phenomenal job of integrating into the community. They are doing everything they can to bring extremely fast and economical internet to this region. And we're so grateful for Ting and all that. We'll talk a little bit more about Ting in the broadcast. So there's that. Now, we want to jump right into the good report. The good report today is about Martin Luther King Jr. I grew up in Spokane, Washington, up here in the Inland Northwest. So understanding the world of the South in the 60s and the civil rights movement was very foreign to me. I've had the honor of speaking at black churches. I've had the honor of having the opportunity to work with people from all races and backgrounds and stuff all over the world in different functions that I've been in. And one of the things that I really value is the ability to come at any issue, even ones important as racism, and looking at things like the segregation that was happening in the South and that can still happen in different areas for lots of different reasons, and to realize that the voices of people like Martin Luther King really tried to level the playing field as much as possible, regardless of people's background, history, culture, and color. And so I just wanted to say a special thank you to Martin Luther King Jr. today. It's part of the good report. I think that, you know, his speech at the Capitol Mall is probably one of the most influential speeches outside of probably the Sermon on the Mount and the Gettysburg Address. There's, of course, lots of great influential speeches, but as far as ones that come to top of mind, those are ones that really stick out the most. I do believe that there is more room for improvement. There's a lot more room for improvement. And so I'm grateful for people who are on the forefront of being able to address these issues in a way that brings things into the right light, not just about the injustices, but about the dream of what the future should be and looking forward instead of always looking behind. So not saying you shouldn't look behind, but I think it's awesome that, you know, his speech, I Have a Dream, is more about what could it look like than what it did at the time. And so we're grateful for that. So cheers to the good report. And for Martin Luther King Jr., we say cheers. Ting, there we go. We're grateful to live in a free society that allows us to have these conversations and to see radical change happen in our society as it's needed in some circumstances. So awesome. With that, we're going to jump into this episode with Chris Bessler. Thank you and have a great day. Thanks again to our sponsors. And here we go with Chris and Chris. Well, Chris, it's nice to have you on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I know. It's
Chris
funny.
And Chris show. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. You know, and I've had people say, do you own Keoki? No, I do not. That's a Chris Bessler. That's a different Chris. Yeah. We both have last names starting with B, and double syllables, but you know, it's pretty funny, you know, how often. And the other person I get confused with is Eric Rust. People confuse me and Eric Rust a lot, but you know. A
couple of pastors. Yeah.
Yep. It happens. So, well, thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me again.
Yep. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about yourself. Introduce yourself to people who might not know who you are, because I think everybody knows your name. You've been around long enough. You have your fingers in enough things, doing enough things that everybody knows, I think, have heard the name Chris Bessler. But tell us a little bit about you.
Well, so, you know, you want the short story, the biography here. So I grew up in Oregon, in a little logging town called Glide, Oregon.
Okay.
And that's always a geography test for people.
Right.
You know where Glide, Oregon is? They don't. No. It's outside of Roseburg, which is, it's south of Eugene, about 70 miles. Beautiful area. You know, I lived there. I actually still have a house there.
Oh, good.
But went to school at the University of Oregon. And upon graduation, I was looking. I went to school in journalism.
Okay.
And upon graduation, I was looking for a you know, a job, basically, and applied around. And a fellow that I applied to up here at the Bonner County, it was actually the Sandpoint Daily Bee in those days.
Okay.
The publisher Pete Thompson called me up about 2 weeks after graduation and asked me about four questions, and then said, "Well, when can you be here?" So I got hired over the phone to work at the Bonner's Ferry Herald, actually, as a reporter.
Yeah.
And what
year's that?
That was 1978.
Okay.
Okay.
Awesome.
So that's when I came to Idaho, was in 78. And I always tell people I moved to Bonner's Ferry. It was a career move.
Right.
Which you don't expect that at a little time, 3,000.
It's interesting because Shelby graduated from University of Oregon. My uncle went to University of Oregon. I'm a huge Ducks fan. Have been for years. My uncle probably graduated about the same time you did. Scott Bassett. He was president of the student body president that year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think
it's a big campus, right?
It is. So. It is. And it's changed a lot. But yeah.
Yeah.
So you were in Bonner's Ferry?
So I came to Bonner's Ferry and worked at the Bonner's Ferry Herald for about a year and a half. And then there's a two-person staff there, editor and me. And then the young guy that was the editor, he ended up moving to Sandpoint to work on the Daily Bee. And I became editor at the ripe old age of 23. Of the Bonner's Ferry Herald.
That's experience right there. Yeah.
Well, and it was, you know, at the time I was the youngest newspaper editor in the state. And and I looked quite a bit younger than 23, actually.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So the county commissioners were like, "You're what? You're the editor now? How are you? 12?
That's funny.
But I was editor at the Bonner's Ferry Herald for a couple years. And then, you know, I left the area for a year, went traveling, came back from Europe. I was broke, called up Pete Thompson, who is the publisher of both the Daily Bee and the Bonner's Ferry Herald, as well as he acquired the Priest River Times. So he owned all three of those papers at that time. Said, "Pete, I need a job. I'm broke. What do you got?" And he said, "Come on." And I started as a reporter at the Daily Bee. That would have been 1982, I guess. I was there for a year or so, then became editor of the Daily Bee. And I was at the Daily Bee when it was acquired by the Hagedorn Corporation.
Okay.
So the Hagedorn Corporation, which is based in Coeur d'Alene, acquired all of Pete's papers at that time. I had a great relationship with Pete. He was a great guy. He wasn't a journalist himself, but he was a newspaper man. He had started as a printer and grown his business from that.
That's cool.
Actually, you know, when he started up the Daily Bee, he was going head-to-head against the established paper at that time was the Sandpoint News Bulletin.
Oh, okay.
Run by the Peach family. Lauren Peach started that. Lauren, I'm not sure he started that paper, but he was the publisher, and then his son Gary was the publisher after that. Uh-huh. Gary just wrote a book.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Sandpoint's Early History. It's a great book, by the way. We helped publish that.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
It's all worth checking out. Anyways, so going back, you know, a long time ago to that period of time, Hagedorn acquired the paper, and I stayed on for about another year or so. So did Pete, actually. Mm-hmm. Pete, which is common when somebody's selling their company, they stay on to manage it. Mm-hmm. He stayed on for about another year. He decided to leave in 86. I decided to leave as well. The paper, you know, it's kind of the trend in the newspaper industry at that time was towards group ownership of papers. So the small independent papers were being purchased by newspaper groups. Mm-hmm. And newspaper groups, by their nature, are more bottom line driven.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Pete was always like, you know, we're going to cover this, or we're going to do that, and, you know, put some reporters on it. And, you know, I don't really care if we're making money with it. He wouldn't say that, of course, because he was a businessman as well. But
that's kind of the mindset, right?
That's the mindset of the small independent newspapers, because the publisher would be deeply involved in the community. Well, after Hagedorn acquired it, even though Duane Hagedorn is in Coeur d'Alene, he cares about the area, certainly. Yeah. But it became a little bit more of a bottom line driven newspaper. One of the first things that happened there is we added a sixth paper. We started contributing to the Sunday paper, which the Daily Beat prior to that time was published just 5 days a week.
Oh, okay. So it was only Monday through Friday.
It was actually Tuesday through Saturday.
Okay.
Yeah. And we started the Sunday paper, at the same time, you know, the bean counters took a look and said, hey, you're a little overstaffed. Let's, you know, you got to lay somebody off your reporting staff. You know, we had, I think, six or seven people in the editorial staff. So we're increasing our workload by, 20% or so, and yet we're reducing our staff. And anyways, what happened was we started to lose control of the quality of the paper at that time, I felt, after having worked previously under Pete. So in 86, I said, well, it's, you know, not for me. And I was wanting to do some other things anyways, try some other things, quit, left the area. Had met my wonderful girlfriend at that time,
Ooh,
Sandy.
Nice.
And so, we went traveling, spent a year in, year and a half almost actually traveling around, went to South America, spent about 9 months in South America, came back up, broke again, looking for work, ended up getting a job on an alternative weekly in Santa Cruz, California.
Yeah. What a move.
Yeah.
Up in a small town in Oregon, then coming up to Bonner's Ferry, Sandpoint, and then Santa Cruz, that's quite the shift.
Yeah. So, and it was a different sort of journalism as well. It was an alternative weekly, kind of like what the Inlander is.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It was actually called the Good Times because it had a heavy emphasis on entertainment, but we also covered, you know, news and political things that were going on. And it was a big weekly. We would routinely published over 100 pages a week.
Wow.
This is in Santa Cruz, which is in the Bay Area. It's outside of San Francisco. Yep. I had a great experience there too. Again, the publisher was the guy that started the weekly. A very entrepreneurial guy. I learned a lot working under him.
That's cool.
As well as right about that time, the industry was changing up because desktop publishing started to occur.
Right.
So prior to this, we were, I started out at Bonner's Ferry, you know, doing writing my stories on a manual typewriter.
Uh-huh.
And it would go to the typesetter. They would set the type in these long galleys. And then we would do a paste up of the paper. So you ended up with something that, you know, all the pieces of the paper would be pasted into place, including the pictures and the ads and the stories.
Yeah.
And then when it went to the printer, they took a big picture of that and made the printing plate from that.
Yeah.
In the early 80s, what happened was desktop publishing became a thing. Really the Macintosh platform was really pioneering there. And with these little computers, remember those first Macs?
Little
guys like
little
that?
Boxes.
Yeah. there was more power to paginate the paper, lay the entire paper out within the computer, and not have to do the galleys and the paste ups and stuff. And it just completely transformed the industry at that time. And the computers then were like $3,000 or $4,000, which was a little bit spendy, right? But far less than whatever it was, $30,000 or $40,000 that a typesetting machine would start.
Yeah, that's a lot of equipment.
Yeah, a lot of equipment to produce a paper prior to that time. So I got my feet wet with using those tools to produce the newspaper. Even though I had a big staff, you know, produce 100 pages all locally written, you know, my staff now at this time was about 14 people.
Okay.
And plus that was just the editorial side. Plus we had production people and ad sales people and so on. So it was a pretty big thriving thing. Santa Cruz is a beautiful area. It's on the Monterey Bay. And it's in the Redwoods. It's pretty gorgeous. You know, a great place to live actually. Yeah. I had married Sandy by this time, or she married me, however you want to look at that.
Right on.
And our son was born in California.
Okay.
In Santa Cruz.
How many kids do you have?
Just one.
Okay.
Yeah. And, after about a little over a year there, the publisher, Jay Shore, great guy, he decided to sell his paper to a newspaper group. And this newspaper group was based in actually New Zealand, but they were acquiring papers in the United States as part of an expansion plan. And we just started going down the same road that I had already gone down, you know, a few years previously with the Daily Bee. And, you know, we no longer had the freedom to make decisions within the staff locally. I actually didn't stay on for very long because Jay decided to start a specialty magazine on outdoor sports stuff.
Okay.
Called it Trips. And he said, hey, you know, I'm going to do this now. Do you want to come on board? So I switched over to doing a magazine at that time. So I made the jump from, you know, weekly journalism to daily journalism, back to weekly journalism, and now to a monthly magazine.
Wow.
So that was kind of the career path that I found myself on.
That's pretty cool.
And
you see how it all plays out, you know, all this experience goes into.
Yes. And, you know, and plus, of course, you know, the changing technology was a big part of it as well.
We'll get into that for sure.
We produced only 4 issues of that monthly, which was like, this is a dream job for me because I like to do outdoor sports stuff. This was it was actually not just for Santa Cruz. It was circulated around the whole Bay Area. We were kind of following some models of a similar sort of publication called City Sports. It was published in other large metro areas. You know, we were making headway, but I think Jay, my publisher, found was he's going to have to invest a lot of money to be properly capitalized to get this thing going. The advertising sales, which that model of a free distribution publication, it's all on advertising sales. We were making progress, but it just wasn't happening fast enough. So after just less than a year there with the startup time and everything, he decided to pull the plug on that. Coincidentally, this is my earthquake story now. Coincidentally, I was in the office, actually the very last day that I was going to be in the office, because we decided to discontinue. I was there just to really write up my resume. It was an old brick building in the downtown area of Santa Cruz on the Pacific Garden Mall, they called it.
Okay.
3-story building. And while I had been in California, I experienced some earthquakes, you know, some
tremors,
4.0, you know, maybe as high as 5 point, which is a pretty good shake, and it shook the building. And I'm like, man, I never want to be in this building if a big earthquake comes. And I had evolved kind of a plan that, okay, if there's a big earthquake, I'm getting out of this building. I can't get down 3 flights of stairs, but what I can do is I can break out the window, and I can, because the adjoining building, the roof was right there. I could jump onto the adjoining roof. At least I'll be out of the building, and if it collapses, right? And so I had just printed my resume and I was walking to my desk in order to pick my stuff up and walk out of the building forever. The earthquake hit. It was the Loma Prieta earthquake.
Okay. Yeah.
The big one that hit in Santa Cruz in 89. It was actually centered near Santa Cruz, but it collapsed the bridges in San Francisco, shook up the baseball field where they were playing baseball.
It was,
and a bunch of people died. Mm-hmm. A bunch of people died in Santa Cruz.
Wow.
And I was, my plan did not work out.
You didn't jump out the window.
Well, it was very violent. It actually put a lot of dust up in the air because the lath and plaster in this old building was breaking, and it was all dusty inside. The windows were breaking, and I was ended up. Well, the first thing I did is I jumped into a doorway that went into the area where we had a printer stand with the printers hanging out up high, and they started falling forward onto me. So I jumped out of that, jumped into a doorway near the little kitchen we had on site there, and the refrigerator fell towards me, and I jumped back out in the middle. So in my experience was jumping around, and
wow.
I was the only one in the room, actually, and I didn't even think about jumping out the window because it was all broken, jagged glass, right? So anyways, the building stood, I'm happy to say.
Wow.
I got out of there, ran, got home as fast as I could, although it was immediate. It was immediately, gridlock on the cars. Yeah. Got home. Everything was good. My son had slept through the earthquake.
Oh, that's classic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd already decided I was leaving the area, and we had decided we were moving back to the Northwest. We weren't sure if we were coming back to Sandpoint at that time. I got a hold of, actually my publisher got a hold of me the next day and said, look, the building's been condemned. They won't let us, they have it cordoned off. You can't go in, but if you'll sneak in with me to help me get my computer out, you can just take your computer stuff.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So it was a Macintosh SE with a full page display for a page layout.
Oh, that's fun.
And I said, yeah, I'm totally up for it. So that night we snuck in past the police, tape and got up there and got our equipment out. And so now I was unemployed, but I had a computer.
Yeah.
Had some training in how to use it, right?
Yeah.
So we ended up retreating back to my place in Oregon, my family home in Oregon, and spent 6 months looking around. And, I actually was interested in the Puget Sound area. I went up. I had a very strong job possibility there, Port Angeles.
Okay.
On the newspaper there. I looked at Bend, no place felt as good as Sandpoint. So I said, hey, let's go back to Sandpoint.
That's cool.
Try to start my own thing. And that was in May of 1990, moved back to Sandpoint.
Okay.
And that's when I started Kyoki, my current
company. So you go through all that craziness, chaos. I mean, it's just a wild story. I was reading that. I was like, that's a good story. So when you get up to Sandpoint and you obviously you learn some entrepreneurial skills from the publisher that you've been working with, down there. And it seems like, you had been stacking skills, right? Like you'd done local newspaper weeklies, monthly magazines, you'd done all this different stuff. You had the equipment to do it. So it was kind of just you kind of within your own capacity knew you could make some money. You knew you could probably find a way to live.
Plus I had connections here too.
Right.
I haven't been editor of the paper, even though I'd been gone for 4 years at that time.
Right.
I came back to town so I had a little bit of a new skill set, especially with the Macintosh.
Computer,
Macintosh wasn't happening around here in 1990 at that point.
Yeah, I could imagine.
They
had just, in 1990, they had just introduced computers into the high schools in Spokane.
Yeah, right. So it's a brand new thing.
Brand new.
Of course, the industry is always slower to adopt these things because it's a big capital outlay. Mm-hmm. They got a capital investment already that they want to amortize. So I came into town and, I rented a first place was in Pioneer Square, just a single room.
Come on, that place has been.
Went out and found an old oak desk for $25. It was a great desk, actually. started, you know, contacting some folks around. You know, I had the idea I wanted to do a magazine.
Okay.
At that time.
Yeah. Were there any magazines happening up here at the time?
No. Well, actually, there was.
Okay.
In Santa Cruz, along with the Trips magazine, we had published a color glossy magazine as an adjunct to the Good Times newspaper.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I'd been working on that as well. It was called Cruisin', and it was a kind of a city magazine that was trying to be targeted for active residents as well as tourists.
Mm-hmm.
I had the idea that, you know, maybe Sandpoint could do something like that as well.
Oh.
It's a tiny market, though. You know, Santa Cruz is many times larger than Sandpoint, for sure.
And,
so, you
and
know,
at the time,
pretty questionable.
A lot wealthier, too.
Yeah, no question about that. But when I moved back, you know, I connected with the Sandpoint Chamber. Mm-hmm. Jonathan Coe was the executive director there. He'd been there for 10 or 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they were producing a newsletter. And I said, hey, I'll do the newsletter. We'll start selling advertising into it. I'll just keep the advertising revenue, but produce the newsletter for you. It won't cost you anything. So I took that as an expense off of the chamber at that time. And he went for that. And so I went out and hawked a few ads. That was my first little paying gig, really.
Uh-huh.
And then at the same time, I knew some folks up at Schweitzer. And they had been producing a magazine. This was back when the Huguenins were on the mountain.
Yeah, Pierre and those guys, yeah.
And they had been producing a magazine called Schweitzer Magazine. It was produced for them by a company out of Montana who would come into town and spend a few days, sell advertising. Schweitzer would give them some stuff about Schweitzer to stick in there. And they come up with a 16-page magazine that had a color cover, but it was black and white inside.
Okay.
It was back in the days when it was a lot more expensive to print color stuff.
Yeah, I bet.
So they said, hey, you know, these guys have been doing this, but we're not really satisfied with the product. And besides that, Bobby Huguenin, who was the CEO at that time, she had a vision that, and Schweitzer at that time was making some major upgrades.
Mm-hmm.
That's when they built the Green Gables Lodge,
fixed
up the road, put in the first high-speed detachable quad up there.
Mm-hmm.
But she had a vision that the magazine that they'd been producing, you know, it served Schweitzer's purposes, but as part of the bigger, you know, if you would, visitor product,
it
didn't really bring Sandpoint into it very much. And she's very plugged into Sandpoint, that family,
right.
of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was a big break for me. They said, listen, just take this over and, you know, we'll buy some advertising in it, but we'll also send a letter out to all the people that have advertised in Schweitzer Magazine and said, hey, you know, we're going to support this new magazine, which I decided to call Sandpoint Magazine to reflect the area.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah. And produce it not just once a year as they did, but twice a year in winter and summer editions to kind of mirror the big seasons we have here.
So
they gave me a great boost with that. And the first issue came out. We actually did 32 pages, you know, and it was at half of that was color.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Because, you know, black and white print, you can hopefully pull off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Mostly.
That was kind of up and going that summer. I was working on that. And the first issue came out in November of 1990 with the cover date of winter 1991. And that was kind of how we got started with Sandpoint Magazine.
That's awesome.
Along the way, we were also acquiring, you know, work for hire, where we would help people with editorial services or design or layout things.
Yeah.
And at first it was just me. And then Sandy Compton,
A
local guy, a lot of people will know, of course, a writer. He came on board, as an ad sales guy, but he did some of the writing too.
Awesome.
Yeah, Sandy gave a big help at that time. I did the layout for the first couple issues myself, and you know, using the old Macintosh, and that's how things got started.
Right.
Basically, for the company, I had $2,000 in seed money and hunger.
That's amazing.
Started
yeah. Right. Yeah. So you're able to get connected, get people involved. What were some of the big challenges in that time period to really get Sandpoint Magazine? Did it feel like it came out with a boom and just kept running hard, or were there some subsequent real challenges for you guys getting that, getting the readership up, getting people to
Well, the readership wasn't a problem. It's a what we call controlled distribution, which is free distribution at specific locations. And we developed a bunch of locations for it. We actually printed 20,000 copies of the first issue. And Schweitzer took a bunch of those because Schweitzer was using it as a promotional piece. And they would take it to ski resorts and give it to pass holders and distribute it on the mountain. But we started distribution at specifically at hotels, chambers of commerce, visitor centers, you know, various shops and stores. And we weren't distributing it in the supermarkets to start with. And we were, one reason being we were eating up our distribution pretty thoroughly and quickly. You know, it comes, since the magazine comes out once every 6 months, we try to measure out the distribution so it's out and available, but we're usually running out of the magazine about 4 or 5 months.
It's not bad.
That's actually about right. You know, because it's mirroring that season. You know, so with like the current issue, we'll probably be running out of that. We're in January now. We'll probably be running out of this sometime in about March. And we'll have completed the distribution.
And then a new one comes out in June. Is that right? Or
in May?
In May. Okay, yeah. Perfect. That's great. And so so how wide do you distribute the magazine now? Like the Sandpoint, how far does that go?
Well, we distribute down in Coeur d'Alene, in Spokane. We get some of the, you know, Bonner's Ferry. So it's outside of just Sandpoint. A lot of distribution in Sandpoint itself, of course. The Chamber of Commerce, it's obviously is a big distribution point. We do now distribute in the supermarkets. And you'll go in there and you'll see a big pile of, you know, 3 foot pile of magazines, and you go in a couple of days later and the rack's empty, right? So especially when it's just out.
Everybody's grabbing them. Do you do like a, can people get them in the mail if they live far
away? We provide subscriptions.
I think my father-in-law has one, because he had the winter one. I'm like, you haven't been to Sandpoint in a while. One of the, and he lives in Portland, so one of the things that you also seem pretty involved in is book publishing, and you've done a lot of book publishing over the years here. We have all of the trail guides, you know, with lots of the stuff that you guys have done over the years, has been really amazing. The quality is always really high, and that's one of the things that's really nice. Like you know, you're getting a great quality book as far as the content layout. Everything seems to be done very well whenever Keoki touches something, which is just great for the reputation, I think, for the area, and of course for you in the business. But tell us a little bit about book publishing. How did you end up saying, okay, well, we're going to do some specialty books? How'd that come about?
Well, so I'm a reader, you know, I love books. When I grew up out in the sticks in Oregon, I used to go to the library and get as many books as I could carry per week and read through them. We didn't have television out there. When I was editing the Bonner's Ferry Herald, I had run a series that had been prepared by an old timer there named Paul Flynn. And it was a diary of a man named A.K. Clockman, who had founded the Continental Mine. Now, most people here probably nowadays don't even know there was anything called the Continental Mine.
Wow, yeah. Clueless.
It's, the Continental Mine is located about maybe 5 miles from the Canadian border north of Upper Priest Lake.
Oh, okay.
And back in the days when there were a lot of miners coming through here in the late 1800s, because, you know, the gold fever was on. And A.K. Clockman came into town and sometime in probably the 1890s. And he'd been kind of a business guy. He had a fascinating story. It's not a very big book, but his story is pretty fascinating. Anyways, he came to town, and he wasn't a miner himself, but he would grubstake miners, and then he would develop the mining holdings, right? So he's a business guy. And he was out canoeing around the lake with an old Indian guide, looking at potential mining sites and properties that he might be able to acquire to do this. And the Indian said, "Well, what are you looking for?" And he says, "Well, you know, we're looking for silver, and there's always often a lot of lead with silver." And the Indian said, "Well, you know, there's a place up in the Selkirks where there's lead just laying out on the ground, and my people go there and get the lead to make musket balls with." And so that set him off to go look for this site. Concurrently with that, do you want this long story?
This is great.
Okay.
Yeah,
concurrently awesome. With that, there was a miner named Billy Houston. And this is the classic miner guy that's, yeah. you know, a crazy guy out there picking at rocks looking for the mother load.
Yeah, right.
Well, Billy Houston and a partner of his were up prospecting in that area, and they found that site that the Indian had told A.K.
Okay,
Clockman
lead,
about.
Lead just laying on the ground.
They found a lead deposit that was exposed up on top of Continental Mountain, which is this site that's a few miles south of the Canadian border. Apparently they found it in the fall, and they decided that Billy would stay up on the site during the winter in order to protect it against claim jumpers, and his partner would go into town and file the claim. So that's what they did. The partner came into town. During the course of the winter, he met A.K. Clockman. Who knows what happened in terms of maybe it was a gambling debt or, talk over beer or whatever, or whiskey in those days.
Yeah, right.
A.K. Clockman ended up acquiring the partner's position in the claim. Billy Houston doesn't know anything about this because he's up protecting the claim, right? And so he's wintering over on site, and this is an area of the Selkirks that 10 feet of snow would not be unusual.
Right.
So A.K. Clockman, spring, he gets some guys, and he's going to go up and find this site where Billy Houston is and say, "Hey, I'm your new partner." And in those days, they didn't have any kind of road yet. There's just a trail up to Priest Lake. So they took the trail up, and when they got to Priest Lake, they built a raft because it was such a rough shoreline. Uh-huh. And they pulled the raft up to the upper part of Upper Priest Lake. As they were nearing the northern part, they look over on the shore, and they see this wild character that's dressed in caribou skins. And he's emaciated, and it's Billy Houston. He's coming down to try to find his partner because he's been living up there, living off of caribou. There were big caribou herds here at that time.
Yeah.
They were pretty easy to hunt, but that's all he had to eat all winter long. So A.K. Clockman met his new partner, and as the story pans out and they develop the holding into the Continental Mine, A.K. ends up kind of taking care of Billy Houston, as they say. And there's some real colorful stories there about some of their adventures together. But what they ended up with, you don't know this now, but there's actually a town called Continental. It wasn't called Continental. I believe the town was actually called Clockman, the town of Clockman. It was at the mining site. They had 300 people living there.
Wow.
In big buildings. It was a big going concern. And they ended up, even though when they found it, they approached it from the Priest Lake side. They built a road down to Port Hill.
Oh, okay.
Over on the Bonner's Ferry side of the Selkirks. And that's how they would get the ore out. And it was a going concern up right up through the 50s, actually.
Wow.
Anyways, long story. But A.K.
Awesome.
Clockman left this fascinating diary telling this whole story. And we published it in serial form in the Bonner's Ferry Herald. And when I came back and started my company, I thought, hey, you know, I need stuff to do. I was still trying to find my way. I'll try doing a book. And I knew that Paul Flynn had the original manuscript. There were no family members left from A.K. Clockman.
Wow.
and so I got with Paul and said, "Paul, I'd like to publish that." And Paul wrote the introduction for it, and we published The Clockman Diary.
Wow.
And that was our first book.
That's so cool.
Yeah. This was back in the days where it was pretty expensive to put a book on the press. So we were being conservative. Actually, I had an investor to help pay for that first printing bill. And we printed just 500 copies and ended up selling those out like right away. And wow. So we put it back on the press and printed another 1,500, and those sold out over the next several years. And it's unfortunately it's now out of print. I'm toying with the idea of putting it back in print because it's such a classic piece of American history. That was our first book. After that, we started doing books more regularly. We actually did some books with Sandy. Sandy's, of course, a talented writer. Mm-hmm. We published one of his books, Caleb's Miracle. Which was fiction. Going through the years, as we published books, we found that we can't really do fiction effectively. The sales and distribution is so difficult. Books are really a tough business to make money in. It's more of a labor of love. But the genre that we really have settled on that works at all for us is nonfiction regional. Mm-hmm. We have published some books. Mm-hmm. We tried to promote nationally, mm-hmm. and there were such a drop in the bucket of whole national marketplace where there are actually hundreds of thousands of books published every year. Mm-hmm. And so one book, one title, what's going to make that stand out? Nonfiction, uh-huh. which is mostly hiking guides, but we've done some history books as well. Is a niche that's got a predictable amount of sales, so it kind of lessens the risk. There's a lot of risk in books.
Yeah,
you make a big investment in the printing, and you may end up with a couple pallets of book in your storage.
Right. Now we move a little bit into the technology shifts, right? Because you go from print being your primary method of media. As far as getting a message out, obviously in an area where local TV is not happening, right? There's no local TV station up here. Yeah. And even unless you got to get cable to get ABC, NBC, CB, the big local stations from Spokane, which still doesn't cover anything really here locally unless it's really bad. The media has shifted so much with technology. Obviously, you talked about the shift in print. And then you also saw a shift in your business model when you went to a conference. I believe the story's accurate. Yeah. You went to a conference and there was a booth next to you.
Yeah.
Right? Tell me that story, because that started launched a whole new genre for you in media.
Yes, it did. The World Wide Web came along. The internet. We were using the internet, of course, from the start for emails. Okay, primarily, and then there was this thing called America Online, which was like this big conglomerate of information you could get, an online encyclopedia and news and everything. And America Online got started in probably about the same time, but it took a little longer to develop. In about 1993-1994, the World Wide Web started to come along. And at first, I was really skeptical because I was a subscriber to America Online. I was like, okay, I understand America Online has a revenue model. You pay a subscription and you have access to all this stuff. And plus, they'd have advertising sales. How is everybody putting free stuff up on the World Wide Web? How does anybody make any money off of that? And I was like, I just don't see it happening. But then the web started gaining more momentum. I was at a book selling conference in 1995, fall of 1995. So the web now has been going on for a couple of years, and you're starting to hear more and more about it, and starting to check it out a little bit online. And a couple booths down, there was a guy selling technology books in this big fat book called the HTML Bible. So I bought that, came back, read it, decided to put together a website for Keoki, and then as an adjunct to that, do something that would utilize some of the content from Sandpoint Magazine.
Okay.
And I called it Sandpoint Online.
Okay.
Thinking about America Online.
Yeah. So what I want to do right now is talk a little bit about Ting. Our season sponsor. Ting has come on as our season sponsor. We're super grateful for Ting, and Ting is crazy fast fiber internet. This internet is, when we say crazy fast, we really mean it. You can watch videos without buffering. You can make crystal clear video calls. You're able to upload and download videos in seconds. So head to ting.com/Sandpoint and learn more about the best internet in town. That's ting.com/Sandpoint /Sandpoint. One of the other things I'll say about Ting is that most internet around here is either through cable or is through the old copper DSL lines. I know that for us personally, we've used the DSL internet lines. We got as fast as we could possibly get here at the housing agency as we were looking at launching this show, and it just wasn't going to cut it for live streaming at the fastest possible that they have. It just wasn't fast enough for what we wanted to do down the road. Thankfully, Ting was right here. We were able to get installed, get everything put in here, and we were really excited about that. So we have extremely fast, extremely reliable. We're able to upload this entire hour-long episodes in literally just minutes. We are super grateful for Ting coming on as our season sponsor. With that, go to ting.com/Sandpoint. If you don't have Ting in your area, when you put in your address, you go there, go to the website. If it's not there, pre-register. When you pre-register, you get a $200 discount on services when they get to your area. Plus, it lets them know that you want it at your location, which is great. So make sure you go to ting.com/Sandpoint and get their crazy fast fiber internet. All right. So with that, we're going to go back over here to the episode. So you named it Sandpoint Online.
Sandpoint Online. Yeah, I didn't, didn't even give it its own domain. I had the Keoki.com domain. I had Keoki.com/Sandpoint Online because they charged the egregious sum of right, $35 to register a domain.
Ridiculous.
Seemed like a lot at that time.
It did. That's true.
Except that the smart people were buying domains left and right I'd even tell a little story there. So we developed Sandpoint Online, added content to it. From the go, we decided to make kind of the content feature there really to be the Vince count, stuff happening on the happening in Sandpoint, not news because I wasn't prepared to, didn't have a news gathering staff really,
right.
But I could report on things that were coming up, events that were going to be happening, and excuse me, I got a cough again.
No worries.
Talking too much, so it's.
We can refill your water too if you want.
Okay.
So. In fact, Alyssa, can you grab me another coffee and maybe fill up Chris's water?
Sure. Do you want me to pause it or keep on recording?
Just keep it on the wide angle.
Okay.
And we'll just keep chatting.
Yeah.
She'll grab more.
So with Sandpoint Online, again, I built it on an extension of the Keoki.com domain.
Right.
And from the go, decided I was going to, you know, really feature events, things that are coming up, and try to make it a place you'd go to find out what's happening in Sandpoint. Yeah. And it started growing. And after a little story here, after I had it going for about 3 years, I thought, well, I really need to get the domain, sandpointonline.com.
Right. Yeah.
Well, the domain aftermarket had taken off at this point. People were buying
Somebody
bought it.
Oh, no.
And the guy that bought it, he had made a business out of this. He had actually bought the domain go.com, and he ended up selling it for seven figures to Disney. I don't even know what happened to it. I don't know what you'd see if you went to go.com, but that's how crazy that environment was at that time. So I ended up buying the domain. It cost me $2,000, a little more than $35 I would have paid if I was just registered from the start.
So funny. Yeah. There's been a few domains over the years that I've purchased and spent more than just the basic, you know, like for the church's website.
Yeah.
Somebody had HVWC for Harvest Valley.
Yeah.
Had that locked up. And so I went in, you know, email, negotiate.
Yeah, yeah.
They're like, we want 5,000. I'm like, I'm not paying you 5,000. Yeah, yeah. And I ended up getting it for like $500 or something.
Right. I've done that actually. I helped clients broker you know, some deals, when you can see that domain is owned but it's not being used, correct, then you, yep, there's might be an opportunity to get that. And now, of course, you know, it, what at the start it was .com, .org, .net.
Now it's
there's gazillion. There's so many different extensions now that there, you know, the question is, does .com become the prime real estate? It still is top of mind for most people. But you don't really need to buy a .com now to have a good domain.
.tv. It's great for stuff like this, you know, but nobody buy that. No, I bought it.
I know.
I bought everything with Bonner Breakdown in it.
I'll tell you what, that's the first thing when I'm talking with, we do a lot of website development now for customers. That's the first thing that I tell them to do. Hey, if you're even thinking about it, just buy it, because it's about $20 now for a domain.
Seriously.
And and
it doesn't make any sense not to.
It's as a marketing expense, it's super cheap. First investment, grab it if you think you're going to use it. And if you don't use it, you know, you lost $20. No big deal.
Not a big deal. That's good. So so you build your own website, you start Sandpoint Online kind of as an event organizer for the community, but with online.
I could utilize stories from Sandpoint Magazine there. But started it doing, you know, really focusing on events, you know, place to go to check things out. And, you know, over time it's grown considerably as well. I mean, we do have archives of Sandpoint Magazine available from there, although we now have sandpointmagazine.com as a dedicated site for that. But, you know, there's a...
You're fine. No, it's good. It's just live. It is what it is. Don't worry. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And, you know, so there's a free classified ads there. There's a business directory there. One of the big things now is when they were putting up the new light standards at Memorial Field.
Oh, yeah.
I spotted that they were going to put new nesting platforms for the ospreys. And so I approached the city and said, hey, let's put a Osprey cam, a webcam.
I love that.
On the Osprey nest.
That's great.
And so now we bought the equipment and we operate it, and but we partner with the city, obviously. You know, Kim Woodruff at the City Parks and Rec has been just great. And that that alone gets hundreds of thousands of views over the course of the year. And when there are ospreys there and people are checking them out, it's a live stream.
It gets shared all over the place.
In fact, we added a we also partner with the Birds of Prey Northwest. Janie Veltkamp there. She's the director, and she's a biologist. So whenever anything comes up that's like, what's going on with the birds here, we can ask Janie to interpret, you know, what's happening. And in fact, there was a really big event that happened two seasons ago. There's two nesting platforms there. We have our camera on one. Across the field, there's another nesting platform. And the two adult ospreys that had chicks in the nest were agitated about something. And they left the nest, and they weren't sure what happened. It could have been a predator bird. Could have been a drone up there. But they were aggressively flying around, and Janie said she's never heard of this before, but they collided in midair and killed them both. And actually somebody saw them, that one of the parks guys saw them drop, and you know, there were two carcasses down on the field.
Oh my gosh.
And so they got in touch with me because, you know, we're so involved with ospreys and stuff. And we knew there were chicks up there. You know, we could zoom in. We could see there were chicks in the nest from, we didn't get a real good picture of them because way across the field. But with our camera, we could see there was chicks in the nest that were going to die because they had no. So we called up Janie at Birds of Prey Northwest and got the big lift truck out and went up and got those chicks out. And Janie, there were some local volunteers that helped with that. And Janie took the chicks. And actually, what you do with baby chicks like that, she put them in other nests down around Lake Coeur d'Alene. She's based in St. Mary's. You know, so a nest might have two chicks in it, and the mom takes off, and she comes back, and there's three. And apparently she doesn't really notice because she'll raise that chick as her own. And both of those chicks survived the season
awesome.
And thrived and fledged.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's awesome.
So well,
that's a great story. That's a great story. I do a segment at the beginning of each episode called The Good Report. That was a good report. Yep, that's good.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at the transformation of media over the years, all right, so we've got print, and obviously with your background, that's been a big part. And then you move into websites, a big part. Tell me, what role do you see social media playing in this bigger landscape of media right now?
I don't know. We do a lot of stuff on social media as well, of course. So over the years, my company has morphed from just, I started as Keoki Company Publishing, right?
Yeah.
As a print, strictly a print thing. Internet came along and websites, we all along have been using the staff that produces the magazine, our small staff, to do work for hire, doing brochure design and so on.
Well, you built BCHA's first website.
And then as we started doing websites, we started doing website design and hosting. It's actually become the bigger part of our business now, the digital world.
Yeah.
It's now accounting for about 60% of all of our revenue.
Okay.
And we host close to 300 websites on our server. Most of them are kind of regional, a lot of really small websites, but some bigger ones as well. Actually more recently in the last couple of years, we started getting websites from around the Western United States because we're building kind of a vertical marketplace for building contractors.
Oh, good.
Doing, kind of specialty website and digital marketing for building contractors.
Yeah.
So now we have clients that are in Phoenix and Denver and San Diego and Las Vegas and Bay Area.
That's great.
Seattle, Salt Lake City.
Well, that's awesome. And you see a lot of the website development companies moving into niche markets in order to, really hone that specific market.
You get a lot of cost efficiencies. When you start doing things for a specific market, you become, you understand their needs and how they connect with their customers.
And they get much higher value
out
of that. That's great. Yeah. Awesome.
So we do a lot of stuff on social media with our clients. We have our own proprietary, Sandpoint on Facebook for Sandpoint Online and Sandpoint Magazine. If you're a business, you really should have a social media presence, I think.
Absolutely.
Now, that doesn't mean you're going to get a ton of people that like you, If you're media sites will get a lot of likes, but business sites won't necessarily. However, it is a cost-effective advertising platform, so you have to have that presence there with your site in order to utilize the advertising platform.
If you could give a small business one tip, just give them one tip. If you're a small business and you've got social media, what do you do? One tip.
Well, pay enough attention to your social media presence to keep it current.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean you have to be on it every day. What we do when we work with a lot of small business, they don't want to mess around with it. So they'll put up a website and they won't touch it for 6 months or 9 months.
Yep.
And it actually ends up being a detriment to you at that
point.
Because if somebody's checking you out online and they come to your Facebook page or your LinkedIn profile or whatever, and it's got erroneous information or really dated information in it, it sends a signal to your potential customer that you're not really on top of it.
Yeah.
So if you're going to set up a social media presence, make a commitment to devote the resources to at least minimally keep it current.
Yep.
That's
good.
You experiment with using the advertising platform.
Yeah.
Now I say that even though I don't like what's happening in the advertising world because digital media is really upending traditional media.
Okay.
And there's a tremendous amount of movement from using traditional media advertising platforms by businesses to doing digital marketing.
Yeah.
And and Facebook and Google are gobbling up all of that.
It's amazing. Pretty wild.
Yeah. And it's because they're collecting information on all the users and can give you a very specific set of criteria that you can market to these your potential customers to. It's good for you, right? I mean, you can say, I want to reach, you know, 50-year-old women that live in this locale that are
divorced
and interested in hiking or whatever, you know, and you can make a very specific marketing message, so you're not wasting your money your message to people that aren't even part of your demographic. But on the other hand, it's an insidious sort of thing that's happening where we're surrendering so much of our personal information, and we're going to see it more and more. Right now, you notice that if you go and look at a pair of boots on Amazon,
it's crazy.
All of a sudden, those boots appear in your newsfeed as you bop around the rest of the internet. Well, you got cookied when you went there.
Yeah.
And,
well, and now with audio, too, if you have Alexa or you use Alexa a lot or you even on your phone, my wife and I have had conversations about something that we're considering. We haven't even, we just have a conversation. We haven't gone on our phones. We haven't done anything, but our phones are sitting there.
That's right.
And then the next, like 2 hours later, ding, that thing just pops right up. We were talking about adopting a pet. You know, we know where we're going to go to adopt the pet. We know what we're going to do. We've owned pets. We've had a cat. And all of a sudden, all this pet stuff starts popping up, and we're like, what? You know?
Yeah.
Pretty intense.
It's actually kind of scary. you know, I mean, in 1984, we were all scared about the government surveying us.
Yeah.
It's turning out the big businesses, and they're gaining all this information.
Yeah.
And things like, you know, what you experienced with Alexa, it's going to get even more intense as things go along. And there's been no effort to yet, or no public will to kind of break up Facebook or Google. They're totally dominating those spaces.
There's a handful of people who are really going after that right now, but they're very few and they're not popular.
Yeah. I think at some point there's going to have to be that reckoning. And they had all the antitrust legislation in the 1920s because of the big oil companies were
and then
were
we had the telecom breakups in the 80s,
That's right. And we saw a benefit from that. I mean, phone bills dropped a hell of a lot. There's a lot more innovation that happened. There's a tendency. I'm a capitalist because I've been running my own business for years. But there is a tendency in what we call late stage capitalism to tend towards monopolization. And when that happens, all the benefits we get from capitalism, the free marketplace where people are vying for, you know, produce the best product at the best price, that gets turned on its head because somebody controls all the means of production and the distribution, and that big company then can dictate the terms. And that's actually what's already happening with Google.
Yeah.
And there's a handful: Google,
Facebook, and Amazon.
Facebook,
those three.
Amazon, Apple is a player there too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And those guys are so big, and they're fabulously wealthy.
I'm like, okay, if you're working in the model and you're making great money, awesome. Are you providing a service that people are buying? Clearly you are, right? Like everyone is on Facebook, they're using Google, they're using these things. But then there's also this other side of it where you're like, okay, at what cost is the convenience?
Yeah.
Like it with Amazon, at what cost is the convenience of it? You know, what's it cost you locally for local businesses?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when it's easier to order a bottle of vanilla online than to go down to, or for $8 cheaper than to go down to your local market. You know, I mean, that's a wild conundrum.
It is a conundrum. I mean, I use Amazon all the time.
Yeah,
myself.
We do too.
You know, I mean, even though if I know I can find it locally, and I'll go buy it there for sure.
Yep.
But there are a lot of times where I'd have to go order it, wait for it to come in and pay more for it versus just jumping on Amazon and getting it then, you know, 2 days later.
Yeah. It's pretty wild. Pretty wild. And you know, when we talk about like social media, obviously I think social media has really, the way that social media works has played a huge part in the increase of division in the country too.
The polarization
of it. You know?
Yeah, we're siloing out, no question.
Totally. Because if I don't want to hear your point of view, I don't. I can mute you on my feed, and I don't have to. I don't have to listen to anybody I don't want to listen to.
Yeah.
You know, if I don't like it, you know, it's kind of interesting.
I mean, it's not just social media. We're already when cable television came along, mm-hmm. and all these different, hundreds of channels came along, right. And you could start watching the news source that reinforces your pre-existing beliefs.
Yeah.
And, you know, those guys are making book on it. I mean, you have both MSNBC for liberal people and Fox for conservative people. And if they just watch those things, mm-hmm. then they're going to get caught in that mindset that, mm-hmm. you know, the other guys are the enemy. And, it's a very destructive pattern that we're locked in right now. Yeah. And I don't even know how we're going to break it. It's so
troublesome. Well, I think we're doing it. I think the more conversations, like the more people, like that's one of the things that I really want to see happen is the conversations between liberals and conservatives, between people who are you know aggressively on the right and aggressively on the left to have these conversations, and to come in with some ground rules, you know, as far as like, hey, you can't speak negatively of each other. Let's talk ideas. Let's talk. You know, we've got, I think that was the most famous line from the election in 2016 is, no, we have alternative facts. Yeah, you know, it's just that there's such a huge glaring separation of realities right now. And some people call it like two movies on one screen, mm-hmm. you know, like with all the same things are happening, but we got two different movies playing out. And so, okay, how can we kind of come in the middle and kind of see the screen, see each other's screens a little bit? I think that'll be super helpful. But social media, I don't think helps that much at
all. I don't know why people feel, a lot of people will post anonymously. They won't really use their real name.
Of course.
And those are the folks that will post the most vitriolic stuff.
That's going to end, I think, really quickly. I think with everything Twitter's been going through, I think the anonymous postings are going to be stopped. I think that's the next move.
It would be healthy to do that. You know,
I think that's the next move.
But even so, even people posting under their real name on Facebook, mm-hmm. they seem to feel a little. Some folks seem to feel a little more freedom.
Keyboard courage.
To be insulting to other people that have opposing views.
Absolutely. I have a friend who posted a pro-Trump thing on her site, and somebody said, "I'm just so disappointed in you." And I'm like, "That's so inappropriate." You know, like to me, it's like. Regardless of that, like to make this deeply personal is not good.
Right.
It's politics. It's, you know, like, we should back up a little bit.
Yeah.
So
we're seeing it reflected in the way the media universe is being reshaped.
Totally.
In the last 15 years, I just looked this up before coming over here to get the fact for you.
Good.
In the last 15 years, there have been 1,400 local newspapers have gone out of business.
Wow.
And they're really struggling because of the the first trend that I was a part of was the group ownership of newspapers, mm-hmm. and that started to thin out the number of newspapers. Mm-hmm. Newspaper groups would buy properties, and sometimes they would discontinue them because they weren't financially viable, but they removed them as a competitor. Mm-hmm. But the trend is super accelerated now with so much advertising moving to the digital sphere. And so local newspapers are really struggling. Mm-hmm. Right now, the Salt Lake City Tribune, which is a big newspaper in a big metro area, is reforming as a nonprofit organization. And there's a trend right now for newspapers to try to go to nonprofit organizations so that they can base their revenue model mm-hmm. less on advertising and more on donation.
That's wild. Well, I just was doing a little study as well. And one of the things that I saw was that the local paper is still the most trusted news outlet in America.
Yeah. Yeah,
because the local paper
that's right.
is not, it's in its like small town local papers, right. not big town local papers, but the small town local is still the most trusted thing because you know, it's just, it's my life. This is mm-hmm. my little world here, you know.
Right.
And so it's interesting.
You can know who the reporter is.
And, yeah.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Yeah. And journalists, you know, they're caught in this partisan divide that's going
Absolutely.
On. If they are reporting facts objectively, and it's on a subject that, you know, you feel strongly about, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and the facts weigh against your pre-existing belief or opinion, then you feel like they're attacking you or attacking your opinion,
they
or
make it personal.
They make it personal.
Yeah.
And you know, the journalists really are making a good faith effort just to get to the truth. Yeah. What are the facts here?
Yeah.
Put the facts out there and then let the folks formulate their opinion based on those facts.
But we're
in such a locked in such a partisan divide right now that if the facts stack up against you, you're going to attack it.
I'm always very cautious. I read all over the place. I'm a kind of a news junkie, and whenever I read an article, you can tell when they move from fact to opinion, right? Even in like a non editorial piece, but just like, here's the news, but then here's this, I'm just going to make a statement as if it's true, but it's actually an assumption, you know, and you're like, ah, you know, you see it just constantly happening on all sides and you're like, wow, let's pull back. That's my, you know, I just feel like
so many
assumptions.
What the reader bears a little responsibility also to distinguish between a piece that's presented as opinion or perspective. You know, you see perspective on that. That means opinion. versus a straight news story where the reporter's trying to relay the facts and, you know, there's different sides. They try to balance the best arguments for each side. Present them, you know, the best that they can, and that's, we need that kind of journalism.
We do.
That's the part that's really troubling as these newspapers go away and we lose that source of somebody at least trying to produce an objective story on it.
Well, I think this is one of the things with social media is that we no longer treat people as real people; we treat them as a screen name.
You know, and
they're not a screen name; they're real people. You know, they're. You know, they serve, they do all the things all around us all the time, you know, and that's pretty wild. So
it's kind of like the, you know, the Thanksgiving table argument amplified out to the world.
Yeah, totally, totally. So I want to hear a little bit about KRFY because you're involved in that. Can you tell a little bit about the story around that and kind of what it is and what it does? For those who aren't familiar.
KRFY is a nonprofit community radio station broadcasting in 88.5 FM. And I got involved in it about 5 years ago.
The
radio started 9 years ago with some guys hanging out at iCarts talking over a beer. And they had an idea that they wanted to, actually the first idea was, let's do a pirate radio station, which in a bigger area, pirate radio station would be somebody that has the broadcasting gear in their car and they actually can drive around and broadcast from different areas and they can't get caught by the FCC for broadcasting without a license. And you know, those things actually do happen in bigger urban areas. I don't know that'd be feasible in such a sparsely populated area as ours. Who would ever really hear it? There's six people might somehow be tuning across the dial and find them. That was their first,
that's funny,
beer powered talk. and they started getting a little serious about it. And, they started exploring what it would take to get a radio station going. Well, then right about then, this would have been about 10 years ago before they actually got on the air. The FCC opened up a spectrum of, broadcast, the part of the broadcast spectrum that would be available to communities to set up community radio stations on.
Oh, awesome!
And they put in a application for a license, and they got it. It took a bunch of ton of work by people that were just volunteers.
That's cool.
They got some early sponsors to chip in some money for equipment and stuff.
Awesome!
And they started it just 9 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been slowly growing over that period of time. Like I said, I came on board 5 years ago. I'm now on the board of the KRFY nonprofit organization, Panhandle Community Radio. It's a nonprofit corporation. Our goal there is to provide a forum for the community to communicate and
awesome.
and you know, present all the different sides of the community. So in 5 years ago when I got involved, this is how it happens in a small town. I had sent a note in to them and said, hey, you should really get some local programming with current event stuff. They didn't have anything like that. They were just doing mainly music at that time.
Okay.
And they'd been actually talking about doing the same thing among their own organization at that point. And so they're, oh, great. You want to help? That's what happened.
Oh, you got a great idea.
Yeah. You want to do it?
Go for it. that's how it works.
And so we got the first one going. We call it the Carify Morning Show, broadcast at 8 o'clock. And then pretty quickly we gained two more shows. So on Wednesdays, I'm on the morning show with Susie Press. She's my co-host.
Awesome.
And on Tuesdays, there's a couple others. And on Thursdays, there's a couple others. So Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, we're running an hour long.
Awesome.
Current events program. It's a talk thing just like this.
Yeah, that's great.
And along with that, the station is doing great. There's a ton of people that are involved as local broadcasters, and so they'll submit an idea for a particular type of music show they might want to do.
Okay, cool.
We have a bunch of local broadcasters that come on and do music shows. There's some great shows on Sunday now. Actually every day of the week, practically, there's different music shows, where the local DJ will choose the music that they play and tell
That's
little
awesome.
Stories
so
about
fun.
The music and so on.
That's great.
During the midday, it's Otto's Eclectic Mix, and that sounds like OTTO. And it gained that name because it's actually automatic. there's a computer that's picking the stories midday, but it's programmed by some of the station personnel. They're very savvy about about music genres, and kind of like doing Pandora, where you pick a song, and then the computer will look in to find similar sorts of music. Mm-hmm. So Otto's Eclectic Mix, which plays midday, is really quite good.
That's awesome.
You should definitely tune in to 88.5 KRFY and check out the music during the middle of the day. Check out the current events programming. The early evening hours is usually when people have their radio, their music shows going. There is some syndicated news on there as well.
Mm-hmm.
To get the whole schedule, go to the website, krfy.org.
Perfect.
By the way, it streams there. So you can be
anywhere.
In fact, we have listeners even in Europe that
cool.
that tune in. Go to the website and go to the schedule page. And actually, you'll see the whole schedule for the shows that are set up for the whole quarter, actually.
Oh, good.
I definitely encourage people to check out the schedule. And, you know, you get, it's a lot of colors and little words and stuff.
Sure,
but if you take a few minutes to look it over, you can say, hey, there's something I might be interested in hearing, you know, at 8 o'clock on Thursday mornings or whatever.
Yeah.
So
cool. Good. Well, I appreciate you coming on. I think we're going to wrap it up a little bit.
Okay,
what's kind of the next big things for you coming up?
For Keoki, our media marketing company, you know, we're going to be really busy working on this vertical market product for building contractors. We're seeing a lot of growth there. Actually, we're up to 14 people now, which is, starting. It's a big jump for us. Over the last couple of years, we've added, I think, 5 positions, trying to keep up with the pace of potential growth that we have there, at least. We're going to continue doing the local media. You know, we're also a business partner with the Sandpoint Reader.
Oh, great.
So we're involved with that. It's a completely independent LLC, actually.
Yeah.
But we provide some support for their website and some other business support for them.
Good.
So we want to grow our local media products.
Awesome.
We want them to stay healthy. You know, want Sandpoint Online. We're actually working on a big redesign of Sandpoint Online. It's using technology that's pretty aged now, needs a complete revamp.
Yep.
And if that goes as we hope, you know, that we have that going by this summer.
Yeah. Oh, good.
And, yeah, just, there's tons of potential and possibilities.
That's
and it's
awesome.
Figuring out the ones that are going to be the good fit for us.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to have you on again after a bit. One of the things that some areas that I think would be fun to discuss more is the changes that you've seen in the community over the last, you know, however many
40 years
that you've been here. And then also, you know, looking at, you know, what the, you know, I know that you're an avid basketball player, and I'd love to talk about some of the other things that you love to do and enjoy, but
okay.
You know, but we'll save all that for another time.
Okay.
And appreciate you coming on. Thanks.
Yeah, you bet.
Okay, have a good one.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Chris.
You bet.
All right.
That's that.